If you admire great images of animals in the wild, I think you're really going to enjoy this program. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Jeff Hogan has been filming wildlife behavior for over 20 years. His clients include National Geographic, BBC, ZDF Germany, among others. He's won several awards and has been nominated for 3 Emmys. So it's great to have him with us today to talk about the ethics of photographing wildlife. I have many prints at home, wildlife prints at home, from a fellow by the name of Tom Mangelson. And Jeff Hogan, are you there?
Hi, I'm right here.
Thanks. You may know Tom Mangelson.
I do. He's a great friend of mine. Good man.
Yeah, he's Dennis Dimmick of National Geographic was, I'm a professor at the UW here, and Dennis was my advisee a long time back. So I've had many conversations with him about photography and ethics as well. And a recent National Geographic article brought up the topic of ethics in wildlife photography and videography. What are the ethic guidelines that those in the profession should follow?
That's a really great question. It's really hard to answer. I don't think there's any definitive rule or rules to follow, because it really depends on what you're doing, what you're trying to accomplish. For me, I tend to try to capture animal behavior in motion. And to do that, I like to just be as invisible as possible and have as little impact on an animal as I can, so that I do get the natural behavior. There's so many things that people are trying to accomplish. It could just be art. You want a beautiful picture on the wall. It could be abstract. It could be more of a documentary thing. And it really does vary, so it's hard to define the exact rules to follow.
Yeah, I know. I think BBC, for example, has guidelines, and organizations do have guidelines that that photographers hopefully will use. But it is difficult, and as you say, you have your own ethical guidelines that you like to follow. It seems like, whether it's officially ethical or not, I think staging a set, interfering with animals, probably is not a good idea.
Yeah. Again, it depends on what you're trying to capture. There is, the times have really changed since I started in this business, but there's a lot of things that still hold true, and it really depends on what you're trying to accomplish. For instance, there's one sequence that I had to shoot once of a mouse that was kind of predatory, and there's no way we could film it in the wild. And I'm hired as a cameraman to come into this set that a professional built, and it was quite a large set of a sand dune, and this mouse was actually a captive creature put into this setting. And, we'd have all sorts of little animals that would live in there, mostly invertebrates, bugs, and you try to film this mouse doing what they do in this enclosure. And so, that's not really something that is what I really like to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you do want to show the world this behavior that this particular creature does, there's really no other way. And so, it really does vary. There you go, where, here we're in a set. We're not just affecting the animal. This thing's got captivity. You're feeding it. And it's really funny, because the little burrow that we had in there, somehow this mouse, they had a few different mice that were hanging out. They got pregnant. They raised young in there. It was almost like they were happy as could be. And, so we got far more than we bargained for, and behavior-wise, but then again, you know, this is an animal in captivity. Now, you wouldn't really want to do this with maybe a grizzly bear or, or you know, a mountain lion, but, you know, maybe on this mouse. You know, maybe there's times when some of this type of stuff is justified, and I think it comes down to, you know, respect for really the outcome, the results. You know, what are you really trying to do here?
We have callers online who want to visit with you. By the way, you may have a question for our guest today, Jeff Hogan. He's been filming wildlife behavior for over 20 years and nationally recognized, internationally recognized, as a matter of fact. Maybe you enjoy taking photos or videos of wildlife. Have you ever thought about ethical considerations? Would it matter to you how a wildlife photo was taken? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. Love to hear from you. Mark in Madison, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, Larry, I'm a conservation patron license holder. And with that, you get a subscription to the magazine from the DNR.
Yep.
And with that magazine, you get a calendar every year. And the July picture on the calendar is of a bald eagle carrying a fish over a stream, and the fish has clearly been filleted. And I find that that's probably would lead me to think that perhaps it was a baiting situation where the fish was put out for the eagle to pick up to get the picture. And since you're not supposed to dispose of fish back into the water after they've been filleted, I find some ethics issues there.
Yeah.
And some irony besides.
Yeah. Jeff, comment?
Yeah, no, that's a tough one without knowing the facts. It could be that I know that there's locations where people are fishing and they're filleting the fish and they're tossing them out, and an eagle's come in and just steal these, the scraps.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, maybe this is something that's happening anyways. The fishermen, they're not taking pictures. They're just fishing. And some photographer who's got an eye on the scene says, aha, check this out. I think I'll snap a shot. And, you know, so
I just
really
see some irony. I just see some irony with that being connected to buying a conservation patron's license and then getting that calendar for free.
Right.
It seems to me to be, you know, to be a conflict there. That's all.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Jackie in Milwaukee has something as well. Hi, Jackie. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. I think I'm going to go into the ethics part of it again.
Yeah.
An article in the paper talked about the use of drones for different things that people were using them for. I have no idea they existed in Wisconsin, but that's where this happened. One of the things was a woman used a drone to take pictures of bald eagles in their nests, and the end result of it was that it drove them away from the nest. Now, are there any laws about that? I hate to get you into another ethical thing, but that seemed terrible.
Yeah. Jeff, what do you think?
Yeah, that seems a little irresponsible. You know, I can see where a drone might come in useful in science, where they maybe want to, instead of climbing, you know, up a tree into a nest to count the young or something, and they could use a drone, and maybe the birds flew away and they counted the eggs and the drone got away, left. Mm-hmm. And the eagle came back, and maybe that would be a good use of a drone. But for a photographer to just, you know, kind of run off the eagles and stuff to get photos, that seems like that would be something questionable.
Well, there are some laws or some rules on this. At least just last week, somebody was punished for interfering with, not with eagles, with killer whales. You're familiar with that situation, Jeff?
I'm not.
Nancy Black, who is a U.S. marine biologist, fed some killer whales on a video shoot.
Mm-hmm.
to get them closer to her boat for filming.
Right.
And she wound up with $12,000 fine and put on 3 years probation for luring marine animals closer to the boat for filming.
Yeah, I think I've heard about that. That was a while back, I believe. Mm-hmm.
It happened a while back, but I think it just recently, you know, sort of the end result came out.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a tough, it's all of this stuff for me is a tough call. Reason being, you know, it's like, okay, she baited a killer whale, and, you know, maybe that's really not something she should be doing. Obviously, her peers and the laws said that was a bad thing. And, you know, but then you compare it to ones that are taken into captivity. And, you know, there's so much gray area. And, it really comes down to, I think every individual event needs to be scrutinized. And, you know, what are you accomplishing here? You know, it could be that some activity that would appear to be really blatantly wrong might actually be very beneficial in the long run to a species or an individual animal. And so I find it really difficult for myself to jump to any conclusions on almost, you know, on quite a few of these scenarios.
Yeah, there's, Jackie, I'm not sure. There's probably a harassment. I guess, you know, our national bird, there's probably something out there. You certainly can't harm them, eagles. You can't shoot an eagle. You can't capture an eagle. So there may well be harassment, rules about harassment or laws about harassment of them as well. Jeff Hogan, our guest, he has been filming wildlife behavior for over 20 years for organizations like National Geographic and the BBC. He's won several awards and also had been nominated, 3 Emmy nominations for cinematography. You can join in with your questions or comments. Do you enjoy taking photos or videos of wildlife? What about the ethics? Would it matter to you how a wildlife photo was taken? Love to hear from you. And the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Larry Mueller. Marika Suval, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jeff Hogan, our guest today, filming wildlife behavior for a long, long time, award-winning photographer, cinematographer. Great to have him along as we talk with him about photographing wildlife and the ethics involved with it. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And this is kind of, this show was sort of inspired by a National Geographic article on titled Don't Feed the Bears, Ethics in Wildlife Photography and Filmmaking. There was a companion piece as well on photographing wildlife, some photo tips from National Geographic. And we have both of those posted on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. So you can take a look on my Facebook page while you're there. Shoot us a question or send us a comment. We'd love to hear from you. We have one of the things that I've noted, and this has happened many, many times, I think, is to use animals that have been captured or in a captive setting, but labeled as wild. There are some photos of wolves, for example, that I know were actually taken. They were captured wolves, but the impression was that was left was that these were wolves in the wild. And I, you know, that to me is just not right. I don't know about you, Jeff.
Yeah, no, I think people really need to be honest with what what's going on. I cannot believe that you're going to get the exact same natural behavior from any captive animal as you would if they were in the wild. And, you know, the circumstances are just so much different. And that includes the mouse we talked about earlier on. And you kind of do your best. And, you know, of course, with this mouse, you know, it's, you know, trying to educate people best we can. The wolf scene, you know, a lot of people, you know, they do take the easy way out. And maybe there are things that can be accomplished in a positive light with a captive population, you know. I'm not real keen on it. My passion is to hang out in the wilds mm-hmm. with wild animals, and I'd love to show just what it is that it takes for them, these animals, to make a living.
Yeah.
And it's not that easy. And, you know, to do the captive scene, you know, sometimes it's better to use a captive population for some sort of behavior so that you don't interfere with the population in the wilds, you know, maybe a den site or something like that. But, you know, overall, you know, actually, my choice is to hang out in the wilds.
Yeah. How do you do it, by the way? Are you one of these guys who dresses in camo gear and sits for hours to get a shot?
You know, yeah, I probably don't use the camo gear as much as some, but I definitely hang out in the wilds. And, you know, it depends on the species I'm hanging out with. You know, I just finished shooting a show on beavers, and, you know, I just go to the beaver pond and every day and spend time with the beavers, watching them. When the beavers are sleeping, which is most of the day, I'd investigate, you know, what they've been doing all night long and try to anticipate, wow, what might come next, because, you know, I might only have 2 hours of light to film them with before, you know, it's dark. And so I want to maximize my results. So I, you know, study them while they're sleeping and then kind of sit and wait. And, you know, we become friends, you know,
uh-huh.
most instances. And it's all about spending time in the field. And a real big secret is that you need to just love being out there.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just out there and you're just out there in the wilds, it's not because, oh, I have to get the shot, then I'm going to pack it up and hightail it out of here. You know, that's, you're going to be pacing and you're going to be impatient. You're going to be like, I want to just get this shot and go. Well, that's tough. You know, when people ask me, you know, oh, you must be very patient. Mm-hmm. And that really never enters my mind, you know, because I just love being out there, and while I'm out there, I'm collecting these shots and this behavior on motion.
Yeah.
So
I remember Mangelson talking about spending time in a, Tom Mangelson spending time in a little shack with no plumbing and no electricity and, you know, just a little one, and he stayed there for, I don't remember how long, it was a long, long time, and just sort of lived out from you. That was sort of his base of operations, and I think is like you in that he just loves to be out in the outdoors, and that probably is a necessary requirement for a great wildlife photographer.
Absolutely, and a knowledge of the animals, and in Tom's case, nobody works harder than Tom. Hmm. He's relentless in his efforts, and he's a great spokesman for conservation and for all of the animals. And so, you know, he's always been someone I've looked up to for all the time I've known Tom. And he's a great mentor. He's a great person, a great soul.
I was thinking about his photos. I was thinking of one photo of that he has of a grizzly bear, I believe, with a salmon. The salmon is, you know that shot? The salmon, the bear's mouth is open and the salmon is about to enter the mouth?
Yeah, absolutely.
How in the heck did he get that?
You know, I think you just have to blast away. You know, and Tom always seems to capture that moment when others don't. So
I have my favorite of his, though, is just a kind of almost a still. It's called Snowy Owl on a Barn Roof.
Oh yeah, I know that image.
I love that image, and I have it in my home. So, Sharon in Minocqua has a question. Hi, Sharon. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Another great show.
Thank you
very much. I have a question about cameras and how they focus nowadays. Most cameras are autofocused, and they shoot some beam of light out. I don't know if that light is like a laser. And if it's a laser, does that have any? Can that potentially do some damage to an animal, especially if it's up close?
Yeah, I don't really know how that works, actually. But I don't think it does. I'm sure that it really doesn't do any damage. I mean, it would be be happening to humans as well, and so I can't imagine that the autofocus has any effect on physical aspects of a living creature.
Oh, you must have probably shot at the Rose Sanctuary over in Nebraska with the sandhill cranes.
Have you been there? I haven't.
Oh, my goodness, you should go. It's wonderful.
I've always wanted to, but, I just go where I get hired to go, basically.
Right.
All my travel, it's either, I rarely get to travel for my own.
Somebody else is picking up the tab for your travel.
Yeah, exactly. There's always a gig going on and, something that you're hired.
Well, the reason why I bring that up, though, too, is that the one of the volunteers there was telling me that that light actually can do some damage and that we're supposed to turn it off. But it's very difficult to focus it, when the light is very low. So that's why I was just kind of curious if you knew anything.
I have
about
not.
That. It's that little pre-burst of light that comes out. It could potentially spook the animal as well. I don't know if you've ever encountered it where it's... I know when I shoot birds, because I have to shoot... First off, you're shooting very fast, like it's 1/16, 1/100th of a second. But it seems like the bird is always flying off the branch before the flash even gets there, and I even have a flash extender. And I'm wondering if it's that a little bit of light, that's the focus light, that's causing the bird to fly away before I take the picture.
Good question.
Yeah.
All of my gear is not, there's no autofocus options.
So you're manually focusing?
Mine's always manual, yeah. And I'm not really sure. I know that, I see all these little flashes going off on the stills cameras, and I think, oh, how annoying is this? But I must say that it's probably more annoying to humans than it is to the wildlife, thank you. Because it just amazes me.
I'm a wildlife biologist, and any animal that sees a flash of light is going to be very disruptive to them. And, I mean, even when you're looking through the camera, I had just gotten an autofocus camera when I went to the Rose Sanctuary. I didn't even know it was doing it. I didn't even see the light because it happened so fast.
Yeah.
And but the animals, I mean, I'm a biologist, and animals are so sensitive to everything in their environment, especially anything that looks like a flash of light. So, but anyhow, maybe there's another listener who knows the answer to that question, too.
Right.
So.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, and I've seen some grizzly bears once, now that you mentioned it. I believe there was some sort of bear jam or something going on up in Yellowstone or Teton Park or something, and people were flashing, and it seemed to be that it was really irritating to this one animal. And so it was like, wow, this is, yikes. It's a grizzly bear. This thing's getting irritated.
Yeah.
So back off. But, it could be very, just as much, I think, more than anything, I think the presence of humans is something that I think that people don't realize that, one person, an animal might say, okay, there's one person over there. It's easy to keep my, the activity, to monitor the situation from the corner of my eye. This is the perspective of the animal. But when there's 30 people there, all of a sudden now it's a little bit different.
Yeah.
And I think that's something where think this is one of my biggest concerns, is people don't realize that there's things that one person can do, but three people cannot. And, you know, and there's always this situation where one person pulls over and says, oh, look at this animal, and they get out to photograph it or film it. And next thing you know, there are 30 cars there, and everybody's coming out to film it. And in some cases, that works fine, but in many cases, it's not. And that will drive an animal away. It will really upset an animal. And you know, if it's near a road, you know, you can always say, oh, well, the animal can always leave and walk away, which is most of the cases that might be true. But there also might be an important food source right there that the animal really needs. And so anyways, the number of people, I think, is one of the biggest concerns I have. And I don't think people are malicious about this, but I think people need to be educated that, you know, count the numbers, see what's going on here, you know, and be aware of it. I think that's the big question, is just try to be aware of what you're adding to any situation.
Yeah. Thanks, Sharon, for calling. I appreciate your call. And, you know, another thing we sort of talked, you know, we're talking about the technology. My wife's quite a good photographer, too, by the way, and she does not use autofocus. I don't know if it's there. She could use it, but she never uses it. The types of equipment we have nowadays, we can take shots or play with the photos after the fact, I think, a lot more than was the case. So after the fact, there's a lot of room for manipulating. And, you know, sometimes I guess that could be good and sometimes not so good. Jeff?
Yeah. I was just looking at some footage that I shot yesterday of a wild creature at about 400 yards, and of a mountain lion, actually. And the camera was, there's a little puff of wind that would shake the camera every now and then. And there's technology out there that will eliminate that shake, you know, minimize the wobble. And, you know, is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Personally, I think that's not a problem at all. I think that's a great thing, because really what we're here for is to, you know, witness this animal, see what it does. Maybe if the cameraman didn't quite get it right and it's a little bit too bright, it's okay. Knock it down so it's comfortable to see, because we're not here to be the best cameraman. You know, we're here to just witness the animal and just what it does in the wild. And so, you know, if there's a big hair across the shot, you know, that's okay to get rid of it.
Sure, it's not really affecting.
If you're studying behavior, if you're looking to really study the animal. Now, if you want to go to a photography contest or something, you know, maybe that's a different, you know, you have a different perspective there.
Barnaby and Madison, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi, sorry, I'm on a bad cell phone, but a very interesting conversation. I attended school in Montana and went to a wildlife film festival up in Missoula. And at the time, about 20 years ago, there was a great deal of discussion about the ethics of wildlife filmmaking, because at that time, they were coming up against a lot of the old school guys like Marty Stoffer and other folks who would actually kill animals and drag them out in front of their blind to, you know, get the stuff. Or even Marlon Perkins, you know, those old things that we used to grow up with. I mean, anyone over 50 remembers these wildlife shows that were a staple on Sundays, and come to find out, most of them were staged.
Yeah.
Right. You betcha.
Yeah.
I grew up in that era, and but it was a little different when I stepped into the scene. I was seeing those activities going on mostly when people were being called out. That was a tough time for a lot of people who grew up learning the trade when, and it was acceptable behavior for, you know, Walt Disney and all that stuff. And so, you know, it's kind of like a victim of the times for some. And I was fortunate enough to just be stepping in and seeing that, you know, that's really not the way to do it.
Yeah. Yep. Thanks, Barnaby. Darren in Madison. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much for the show.
Sure.
Great to hear. And I had a question, well, comment slash question. An earlier caller had brought up the issue of multiple people, and you mentioned, you know, one person can do something that three people cannot. I couldn't agree more. I run a kayak guiding company, and I really preach environmental preservation, conservation, and try to, you know, imbue the idea of habitat and wildlife zone connectivity. And one of the things I really have a hard time doing is keeping people in my group, clients, in a paddling posture and direction that will not have an animal leave if we see an animal. You know, say a lot. We see a lot of water shorebirds, and part of what I try to teach people is a lot of birds. A simple kind of an oval shape of approach to go around them, as opposed to ever going straight at them and doing a lot of coasting, is often a way that you can avoid disturbing the animal to at least to a degree that they might have to flee if they're hunting. And I guess, you know, I wonder if you have any other techniques that you recommend, you know, as far as, you know, when you do encounter an animal, if you're not just sitting and waiting in silence, ways to, you know, kind of control your movements, direction, so as not to threaten them and have them flee.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And I'm going to give you an example from before I even had a camera. And, you know, I spent time out in the field, and I was watching a deer. And we just both kind of, I stepped forward and saw a deer looking right at me, and it was just ready to bolt. And I just looked over and saw this big bunch of grass right next to my head, real tall. And I just bent down a little bit and bit it off and started chewing at it and started looking around like I was another deer, like I didn't care that this deer was here. And it just watched me. And before I knew it, this animal was just, we were almost grazing together. And I was able to hang out with this animal. And it's just this attitude where, you know, imagine yourself sitting in Central Park in New York, and you're on a bench, and you see somebody 100 yards away looking at you and just coming straight towards you, stopping and then moving closer, but looking right at you. It's like, yikes, what's this all about? But other people would be talking to each other, and they could walk by and literally bump into you, and it might not mean anything. But that one guy staring at you way far away, what's up here? And I believe the same thing holds true with wild animals. So, you know, kind of walk, meander, don't walk straight towards them. You know, bend over and chew something or look around like they're not your main source of attention. You know, that's not
definitely
really
definitely agree with the eye contact issue. And if you kind of show if you pretend you're not interested in the least in them, even if you're close, I agree, especially if you're alone, similar thing. But next time I'll try chewing on some cattails or something.
Why not?
Thanks.
Thanks, Darren. Thanks a lot for calling. Mike in Oak Creek, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. And guests. Hi, real quick on the whole autofocus thing and lights and whatever. Is first off, you know, any laser that's any true laser light emitting device that's sold on the market needs to have a warning label that it contains a laser and so forth. And that's based on the power and the type of light or the type of laser that it is. Now, as far as autofocus cameras, you know, there may be other technologies, but as I understand it, the two principal one technologies are active technology, and that does use an infrared light. But as I understand it, that infrared light is more similar to your remote control, that it's not necessarily a laser, that it, you know, it's a light-emitting diode.
Yep.
And it does a calculation based on the reflected amount of light coming back. The second type is a passive autofocus, and passive autofocus has multiple sensors in the camera within the focal plane that are able to detect differences in contrast, and it uses an algorithm to determine based on those differences in contrast, you know, whether something is in focus or not. And then lastly, that light that you see that momentarily comes on most of the consumer digital cameras is a red eye protector, if you will. And what it does, it's just a little bit of the flash from the flashlight that causes your retina to close a little bit so you don't get as much red eye. It has nothing to do with the autofocus. If it's a visible flash like that, it has nothing to do with the autofocus. It's more about red eye, and typically that can be turned off.
Yep. Yeah, good points. And, well, Jeff, you don't use those anyway, so you wouldn't.
Unfortunately, yeah. No, they could probably come in handy, but, yeah, all my stuff, even my brand-new HD movie camera, it's all manual exposure as well as focus.
Yeah, it's... what do you think of the iPhones and the, you know, the smartphones and the all of the photos that people are getting now just with their telephone? Think it's a good thing?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I use my iPhone quite a bit for my 7-year-old and all sorts of things, and it's amazing. The technology is absolutely incredible. I just can't believe how far we've come since I started working in the field with a camera. And it makes everything, I'd say, easier, and your results are better. And I think that's okay. I think that's a good thing.
I would heartily agree. Every day, practically, Dennis Dimmick will send something on his Facebook page, a shot that he's taken with his iPhone, and they're amazing pictures that he gets. Oh, my goodness. Well, Jeff, this has been a lot of fun. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Good luck with your photography, or continued good luck, I should say. And again, we appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Jeff Hogan, filming wildlife behavior for over 20 years. His clients include places like National Geographic, BBC, ZDF Germany, ABC Kane, and many others. And you'll see his work. And I hope you'll take a look at the article from National Geographic, Don't Feed the Bears, Ethics in Wildlife Photography and Filmmaking. I subscribe to National Geographic. You may not, but if you're online, you can go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mehler Show, and you can read it right there, along with another a companion piece on photographing wildlife, which is really pretty cool as well. What an interesting conversation, wasn't it? Makes you want to grab your camera and get out on a photo safari someplace. Well, another way to spend a lot of time outdoors is to work on a farm and work in agriculture. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the agricultural sector in Wisconsin. And there's a new survey that's been done by UW Extension. It's really interesting about the wages and benefits paid to farm workers here in the state. That's coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.